Hey, welcome in. We got Brandon Marcello of CBS Sports in here. We're going to talk Razorback football, their season opening win over North Alabama. We'll look ahead to Utah this week. Also get Brandon's thoughts on, there's nothing going on in college football, right?
No.
Nothing? Mm-mm. Not a thing. We'll get his thoughts on all the big stories from around the country. I want to tell you that our podcast is brought to you by Eglin's Best. In Arkansas, greatness starts early, before the pads go on, before the crowd roars. The day begins at the breakfast table. Eglin's Best delivers superior nutrition with more vitamin D and less saturated fat than ordinary eggs. And start strong with Eglin's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, and better eggs. Also brought to you by Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971. They're committed, professional, and versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them now at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. If you didn't see it, Chip Souza was in here with Anthony Hicks, the former Razorback yesterday. They've got some thoughts on the game. They'll go more into detail than Brandon and I will today. You can find our podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple. Just search Whole Hog Sports on any of those platforms. It was surprising what happened with Arkansas.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they win the game, but it almost felt like they lost with the way people were talking afterward. I mean, Ryan Silverfield clearly was not happy with the performance. Betting lines are what they are. You know, I don't think that they're really able to maybe accurately depict the first week of the season.
Yeah.
But even with that said, I think 40.5 is about what you would expect an SEC team to be able to beat a team like North Alabama. We've seen it before in season openers. When you can't push a defensive line from the FCS off the line of scrimmage, you're probably going to have trouble throughout the season. It reminded me of 2023 when Arkansas only averaged like 2 yards a carry against Western Carolina. I think that's the big concern for Arkansas coming out of that game is how are they going to be able to handle, beginning this week with Utah, a team that's always really physical, these bigger, more aggressive, stronger defensive fronts.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was shocked by just how bad the offensive line looked for most of that game. Not able to get a push, being able to run. You know, I kept going back when I was looking at the yardage on the ground to the scrimmage I got to watch. And the defense at that point held them to 2.4 yards per carry.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, you know, it's because they knew what's coming and all that. And then North Alabama holds them to what, like 2.6, something like that, yards per carry. It wasn't much better. And so I wonder now, if that's just how it's going to be, what kind of changes they might make. I haven't kept up with it this week. My head's been buried in courtrooms and LSU, but I do wonder if there's something they can do there. Can you move some guys around? I mean, even when I was there behind the scenes, I remember them talking about one player who I believe was a center going, hey, could he play right guard? You know, they probably need to be trying to think that through, and maybe they are. I'm sure they are behind closed doors. Like, what can we do to move some pieces around potentially, maybe even as early as this week?
That is the worst feeling when, and I don't know if that's how they feel over there right now, but if that ends up being the case where your offensive line just is not up to snuff, that's just not one of those positions that you can you know, say, hey, let's plug in somebody else here and see if it. And you know, this offense.
I have seen teams, though. I've covered teams, though, where they move one or two guys or they elevate one guy, and it's not to say night and day, but it's a lot better. I've seen that previously when I was a beat writer at Auburn, where they moved a guy over to a right tackle spot and they moved someone over inside to guard, and it was completely different. Sometimes that can work, but like you said, offensive line is what it is. Like, the guys you have on your roster are what they are, and you get a pretty good feel of who is good and who's going to be a backup throughout spring and preseason camp. It isn't like someone can just make a huge, giant leap in a few weeks' time.
You know that they're going to be putting a lot of emphasis into looking into what all they can do there. Silverfield's an offensive line coach by trade. He brought in not one but two offensive line coaches to work for him. I talked to him about this a week or so, maybe 2 weeks ago, about just the emphasis that they put on offensive line. It's I'm not going to say it's more than other places, but it's probably as much as other places.
Yeah, Billy Napier, I know, was maybe the only other SEC coach that had two offensive line coaches. And that was his philosophy of, like, I need guys. We got so many different positions there, and, you know, it takes a lot of – I mean, usually when you go to these schools, you know, obviously you've got these grad assistants and student assistants. Mm-hmm. They're practically, they are the assistant coaches for these offense, for position coaches. They're handling, you know, you might have a grad assistant who's at with the receivers coach, and he's handling the slot guys, and the receivers coach is handling everybody else and some other things. So, yeah, it's not too unheard of now to have two of your quote-unquote full-time on-field assistants to be offensive line guys. And I know other coaches have thought about doing that. I think Brett Bielema maybe did it for a year or two, or maybe he was thinking about it. I can't remember, because I remember doing a story about Napier and how they were thinking about doing that. So,
you know, one thing that jumped out to me and is just the accountability that Arkansas's coaches took for that game. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times coaches, they'll pass the buck. Silverfield, he's in the press conference after the game. He says, "That's on me. I got to get it fixed." Yesterday, Tim Crams, the offensive coordinator, talking about K.J. Jackson's interception in the end zone right before halftime. Mm-hmm. He said, "K.J. didn't throw that interception. He said, we threw that interception. K.J. and I threw that interception. I should have put him in a better play to make him successful there." I don't know what that means for this year's team, but that did stand out to me in the last couple of days, just the accountability from the coaching staff. It's refreshing.
Yeah, and you need to have that. You can't be going in there publicly or even privately behind closed doors and be throwing your new team or players under the bus game one, game two, because you'll lose the team quickly. And especially if the team realizes, hey, we probably don't have a shot to win so many games, and what am I doing as far as effort here when I know the coach is not really a believer in me? So that's a good sign. I think we're going to learn a lot more about this team, their makeup, just how good they are at Utah. I know people want to see a silver lining and all that, but like, if they go to Utah and you get beat by 30 points, you need to sound some alarms. Mm. I was watching Utah, and they've got some weak spots that I wasn't expecting. Mm-hmm. You can throw the ball downfield on them. They're going to be physical up front, yes, but there's some things you can do offensively against them to take advantage of some matchups.
This is the first time I was reading about Utah this week, Brandon. They lost all of their linemen, all their starting linemen from last year's team, all five starting offensive linemen, all four starting defensive linemen. When you're playing a team that, you know, we'll see how physical Arkansas really is, but when you're playing a team that the expectation is they're going to be physical this early in the season and you've got that many question marks on the line, no different than Arkansas's got some question marks on its offensive line. I'm interested to see how that matchup plays out Saturday night.
Yeah, most definitely. And it's, you know, just one of those things you talk about. It's a lot of new linemen, but obviously most of the coaches are still there and they've kind of got that culture, and their culture has always been, of course, it's just, we want to dominate in the trenches. Their whole motto is no one's more physical than us out west. You know, no one's going to beat us in the trenches. That's how they won the Pac-12, held off Oregon for all those years. Mm-hmm. And nothing has changed with that just because Kyle Whittingham isn't there anymore. But I'm with you. New is new. Communication is so difficult along the line of scrimmage, even when you're playing at home. And especially in a place like that, because it can be loud even when you're on offense as the home team. And so, yeah, but, you know, watching them in their opener, you can still see that mentality up front. You can still see it there. But I had issues with kind of what they were giving up down the field.
Yeah, their home field, I feel like, is a little underrated. When you look at the number of games they win there, they got like half the seats of an SEC stadium with twice the success in a lot of cases.
It's a lot like War
really,
Memorial.
Really good home.
It's a lot like War Memorial Stadium when you get there. The structure of it. But you got a gigantic student section. Hmm. That's the difference. It's like War Memorial when it's rocking, but the student section is much larger.
It'll be a 9:15 kickoff on Saturday night. I think that's the latest game Arkansas has ever played. You were covering the Razorbacks the last time they had a later or one. The previous latest one, it was a USC in 2005.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I think Hog fans hope that this one goes a little bit better than that
game. I was in the
game.
Stands for that one.
Were you really?
Yeah, I was sitting up in the end zone. Oh, no. Oh, yeah,
in LA.
I was at LA.
In 05.
I was
that was Reggie Bush.
I was at a friend's house watching that beatdown.
Yeah.
Was it 70-17?
70-17 on September 17th, 2005.
Yeah.
You don't forget things like that.
No.
You know, and I remember seeing Peyton Hillis the next day, and asking them, what time did you guys get back? And it was like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And they're worried about that this time around. It's obviously not as long of a flight, but it's still a long flight. And they've got that quick turnaround to Georgia. You know, you think about the first game. It's 101 degrees at kickoff. This week, it's a like 9:15 kickoff. Mm-hmm. Then they've got the quick turnaround to Georgia. It's going to be an 11 o'clock kickoff. I wonder what can be done to, if anything, to get the TV schedule to be more, I don't know if accommodating is the right word or what, but
yeah.
These kickoff times really are a little bit of an issue early in the season.
I think the only way to do that is through that Protect College Sports Act and the potential, and it won't happen, but the potential of all the conferences bulking up their media rights together and putting it to market, because mm-hmm. then you'd have universal scheduling. You'd be able to – schedules would be in flux year to year. You could be very creative with it, much like the NFL, and you could do that, but that's just not going to happen. No one's going to agree to that because everybody's got silo thinking right now.
I saw a lot of videos and photos from across the weekend at different stadiums. Like, I saw something you probably saw from Texas State, where there were literally hundreds of people just not passed out, but struggling from heat exhaustion during that game. You know, it kicked off in the middle of the day too. It's all an Iowa band member, unfortunately, passed away from heat illness. I feel like something needs to be done about these games where it's just exceptional heat the way it is early in the year. And we've said this, it's not going to get any better.
No.
I mean, Arkansas just scheduled a game. Now that they can schedule week zero or what used to be week zero, like, they're going to be playing a game on August 25th in a couple of years.
Yeah.
It's not going to be any.
You just got to hope. You just got to hope we're not in a heat wave like we are right now, where it's about like 10 degrees hotter than usual. That obviously contributed a lot to it, but you're absolutely right. We're going to face this somewhere every single year now.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what happened in week one. I think Western Michigan is the story right now, or a story. Seems like there's two or three that are kind of fighting for the top of the headlines. The MAC mentioned yesterday that they've appealed this outcome. You know, they put out a statement originally after the game Saturday night that kind of read like a hostage statement in a way, but saying that they went along with the Big Ten's explanation, and then a day or two later they come back and say, no, we don't think that the replay protocol was followed in this situation. We want Western Michigan to be recognized as the winner. This is weird.
You know, what's fascinating about all this is, based off of everything I've heard and read, the Big Ten actually did follow protocol. I think what the MAC was trying to do is that there was a rules expert for another network who went on a podcast saying, you know, usually we were told in the past in another league that if you're reviewing something and you have a clock issue, you always go back to the broadcast clock, the one that's on TV, and that's what you go by. And so I do wonder if, like, the MAC saw that and it started catching fire. They're like, hey, we should go with that, saying that officials are told this even though it's not in the book. Well, it's not in the rule book. It's not. But the NCAA, like, late last night or early this morning, started circulating a memo saying, if you guys – we're going to change something here. If you guys have issues with a clock or if there's a discrepancy, now always go with the clock you see on TV. If that was in place a week ago, Western Michigan's the winner today. And so I think the MAC even has maybe even a stronger case at this point, going, you just changed the rule after it happened to us, and you're saying we would have been the winner. There's got to be something done from maybe a CFP standpoint where they weigh this differently. There was one analytics, you know, one of those computer rankings that went ahead on Sunday or Monday and declared Western Michigan a 12-7 winner, and it reflects in their analytics. So this is something that's going to drag on, you know. And here's the thing. Like, everybody just kind of assumes, like, well, what if Western Michigan's in a playoff hunt and, like, they need that win? What if somehow Michigan just keeps winning somehow? I mean, it's not impossible until they get to Ohio State or something. And we're sitting here going, should they really have a win on the resume? There's a lot of issues with all this. But once again, it's just college football in a lot of ways just can't help itself. We don't have, like, straight rules for every situation. And it just seems like, oh, we better do something about that. It's piecemeal every time we go around every week.
Do you think the NCAA wants to set that precedent and overturn a game?
No.
In fact, I don't think they do. I don't
they've
think
never done
does.
It. As far as like a winner or loser, now they've changed scores and stats before. That's mm-hmm. happened, but it hasn't changed the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I could tell in college football, the last time an outcome was changed was 1940 between Cornell and Dartmouth. Cornell was given a fifth down, and they threw a touchdown pass to win 7-3. Well, the athletics director for Cornell felt bad about it and realized it, and so penned a letter through Western Union to the Dartmouth athletics director and said, hey, we did not deserve that. It should not have had a fifth down. We concede the win to you 3-0.
Wow.
And that's the only other time I can see it. I mean, back, you know, the fifth down play with Colorado,
yep.
they appealed that, and the NCAA never turned it over. So
I'd be surprised if they do.
Yeah,
this time.
It'd be shocking.
I feel like the Big Ten makes itself susceptible to criticism by let me go back. I think conferences open themselves up to criticism when they officiate their team's home games. You know, a lot of times in these contracts, mm-hmm. it's written into if you are the visiting team, your conference will come on the road
right.
and be the officials or the referee, the officials, replay officials in these games. I don't know why the Big Ten was – I don't know why that agreement wasn't in place. You know, I mean, early in the season with so many non-conference games, I'm sure conferences are strained a little bit in terms mm-hmm. of who goes where. But I think that what last weekend really underscores is the need for a more uniform
oh, yeah.
officiating
– national
– Yes, national standard.
National standard. We need a national replay center,
yeah.
a command center, so to speak. Put it in Indianapolis. Do that. We got it. We got to have something like that. That's charged up that conversation a little bit more. I just don't think it's going to happen because, again, I go back. We talk about TV stuff
mm-hmm.
It's because every conference wants to do things their certain way. I mean, I asked a Big Ten source, hey, does this give you guys the urge to maybe show more transparency on television? Because this year, the Big Ten on Friday night games are going to start showing you the replay center and the conversations happening. I said, does this open it up? Like, maybe we need to do this more.
Mm-hmm.
And the response I got was, well, you could ask the same thing about the other conferences.
Yeah.
It's always a, well, what about them?
Yes.
That's college athletics yep. in a nutshell.
Yeah. I feel like that's needed. You know, and they have that at like NCAA postseason level.
Mm-hmm.
I think about baseball.
Yeah.
There's a replay center in Pittsburgh that's monitoring like 32 games potentially at one time. Or I guess maybe fewer than that, but you know what I'm saying? It's like they're monitoring many games at
yep.
the same time. I think it could be done. But like you said, I don't
say
I
what you will. That's
the
thing.
That
I was about to say, that leads into the other thing. Like, say what you will about the NCAA, but the one thing they do well is run championship events.
Yeah, they do. LSU. They've conceded on the pro player argument.
That story like shifted and changed like three times yesterday.
Mm.
Like like in the old days, if I was working for a newspaper and we didn't have the internet, like I would have been sitting there doing my third or fourth rewrite right at deadline,
mm-hmm.
going, well, forget everything we just reported mm-hmm. on today. So that went from the SEC saying we're suing LSU and saying we want the right to be able to expel them if we so choose. And by the way, we're going to have that vote on Thursday. And they're asking a federal judge to give them that protection. And then the federal judge rather quickly, that later that afternoon says, hey, we'll have a hearing tomorrow over this,
mm-hmm.
which is exactly what the SEC wanted. They wanted that kind of pat on the back of, go ahead, you can do it. You're a voluntary organization. You have your rules that school and everybody else agree to. You can run that and do that. And then, of course, LSU at the last minute last night goes, hey, by the way, we decided to finalize our 105-man roster. And the two empty spots are now going to two players who were injured in the offseason. They're going to be put back on there, and they're eligible for, you know, the season, NIL, all that stuff. They file it to the CSC and all that, and that's that. So no ex-NFL players can even join that roster if they wanted to at this point. For the rest of the season, they're off the board.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what this whole issue is about, as everybody knows. So the question is today – you know, we're recording this right now, so it's, you know, 30 minutes from now is when the hearing's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And as of about an hour, hour and a half ago, I had someone tell me, as far as we know, the hearing's still going to take place. I think the SEC, in a lot of ways, is going to use this hearing as a way for perhaps the judge to go, yes, you are allowed to do that. You're a voluntary organization. So it gives them the leeway and that precedent to say, now we can self-govern. Mm-hmm. We know we've made our own rules, but now we can punish our own schools, our own players. And this really is a first big step. If they get that vote of confidence from the federal level, that we can start developing our own rules that maybe like the NCAA used to or the CSC, mm-hmm. and they're maybe a little bit different from the other conferences, and we can self-govern. And this is something the SEC and the Big Ten have been looking into and developing since May. A lot of administrators, I can tell you, across the country are keeping their eyes on this hearing. They're hoping the hearing happens because they want to hear that judge say, move forward, SEC. Now, as far as LSU, if that happens, if the judge says, go ahead, I have doubts that they actually do the vote for expelling LSU. Mm-hmm. I do think that meeting's still going to happen. As of this morning, speaking to someone that I know, I think that meeting's still going to happen, and they're probably going to discuss other things about LSU, like mm-hmm. should there be punishment for things they were doing beforehand. But I think that both sides, LSU and the SEC, this morning and going in the afternoon, both sides were talking, and the way it was termed to me is like it's a de-escalation. So think of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
It's kind of what happened, yep. And they're both sides are talking. The missiles are starting to go back down into their silos. Everything's fine, but there's going to be some repercussions from this still.
How serious do you think the SEC was about potentially expelling LSU before all of this went down last night? How worried do you think LSU was about that possibility being real?
If they had a true vote, and by true vote, I mean it's like, you guys want to expel it, you guys realize this or whatever, mm-hmm. I don't think it would have happened.
Okay.
Still, though, there was a meeting last week where they said, hey, if we had a vote right now to vote LSU out, there was consensus to get it done. Mm-hmm. Now, that's probably a lot of presidents sitting there acting off emotion at that moment mm-hmm. and not going back to their constituents and going, what does this actually mean? Mm-hmm. Now, if LSU pushed this even further, say yesterday, mm-hmm. if they just straight up said, we're fighting this, we're going to court against you again, we just filed a motion in the federal court now to stop this, I think that may have charged it up even further, and we'd end up having that vote Thursday, and there's no telling. I think everybody was waiting to see what LSU would do, and the SEC, and for that matter, a lot of people along college athletics, got what they were hoping for, which was LSU to blink. Having said that, you saw some politicians in Louisiana yesterday. You saw the school president tweeting him a video of him dancing with his wife on the sideline, mm-hmm. like they weren't worried about all this, and then they blinked anyway. So just a lot of hot air out there.
One of the things that gets focused on, obviously, throughout the year, throughout the summer, whenever, hot seat. What coaches do you think did not help themselves in week one?
Dabo Swinney. I mean, I think that's a very easy one. His buyout's massive. It's crazy. Like, I think actually he's got a weird buyout where it's $57 million you fire him during the season, but it's actually $60 million after the season. Some weird thing in there. Either way, that's still a lot of money no matter what. That one's going to be difficult. One maybe no one really cares about is Charlotte, Tim Albin. He's really struggled these first 2 years, and there's not a lot of push for him to stick around even longer. Luke Fickell at Wisconsin. Luke's problem has been that he was slow to adjust. Mm-hmm. He has admitted to that. He admitted that to me at Big Ten Media Days back in July. I probably waited a year or two long to really go after transfers with NIL and also get the people around the program to give us more NIL money. He also screwed up with some hires early. And now he's embracing that. It's a little bit too late. Mm-hmm. Their team's better this year, even though they got blown out by Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. You watched that game for 2.5 quarters. They were in it.
Competitive, yep.
I think he's very much on the ropes. Dave Aranda at Baylor, that's a pretty easy one. You could tell. I think them just going for two was his way of saying, this is it. This is mm-hmm. if I get this, the heat's down for a little bit for now. Greg Schiano at Rutgers. His buyout's about $18 million. Like Wisconsin, you're seeing this more and more. There's three programs, and they're all in the Big Ten. This year, they gave more NIL money. They really helped the coaches this offseason. We're going to help you out here. In a lot of ways, it's like, here's some rope. Mm-hmm. Do what you want with it. You can hang yourself with it, or you can tie this thing up and get it going. And that's one of the programs. And Rutgers is worse than it ever has been before under Greg Schiano as far as talent.
You didn't mention Norvell.
Oh, well, you know why? It's a given.
Oh.
he was almost fired last year. I mean, they were, after that Stanford game, there were meetings going on at night, a lot of boosters and people, and it was pretty much called off about 2-3 hours before it was going to happen. So, yeah, I mean, you lose a game against anybody, and you've practically won the turnover battle 4-0.
Mm-hmm.
You got a bad team. And everybody I talk to around the country that know football, they watch that team and went, man, that ain't no way he's sticking around.
A couple of U of A alums got a lot of airtime. You got Rhett Lashley. Yeah. You got Taylor McGregor. But she got she was universally praised for how she handled the electricity outage there. And you know, a lot of people were real proud of her. I know from the U of A who I know who were her professors. So good job for her.
Absolutely.
Brandon, we appreciate you being here. Brandon's in here every Wednesday. We'll talk Razorback sports with him. Also, what's going on around the country on Wednesdays. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll be at the Hogs Illustrated Sports Club. We're going to have a Q&A with Hunter Yurecek. So you're not going to want to miss that. Tomorrow's podcast. We'll see you then. Have a great day, everybody.
LPGA Week in Northwest Arkansas returns this September as we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Walmart Northwest Arkansas Championship presented by P&G. Join us September 21st through the 27th at Pinnacle Country Club in Rogers to watch the world's best female golfers compete. Plus, enjoy family-friendly activities, food, and entertainment all week long. Tickets start at just $10. Visit www.nwachampionship.com to learn more and purchase your tickets today.